Let's cultivate our motivation and consider how fortunate we are to have the circumstances in this particular life that we do, considering that not everybody who is born as a human has a precious human life. So it's not just the human body and the human aggregates, the mind as well, but being born in a situation where the Buddha's teachings exist in the world, where we have access to them, where there are teachers and monastic communities, Dharma texts, and also the fortune that from our own side we're interested in the Dharma. Just consider how many people are on this planet and could potentially have access to the Buddha's teachings and communities and teachers, but from their side have absolutely no interest. And so it's important to respect and cherish our own spiritual inclination, not take it for granted, because so easily one could be born without it, and in previous lives we have been. So it's important this life, as much as we can, to put good seeds in our mind, habituate our mind with the Dharma, progress along the path, gain some insight, so that in future lives we'll be able to continue on. We won't backtrack and be born as a football player or a merchant or ice skating professional or, CEO. But in future lives we'll have some Dharma imprints and attraction to the Dharma that will get us going on the path again. And so one of the best ways to do that is through being ordained in this life, setting the foundation of ethical discipline to attain a human body and human mind, and then practicing the teachings as much as possible so that we gain all the other circumstances for precious human life. And let's remember that we do this not simply for our own benefit, but in order to reciprocate the incredible kindness that has been shown to us by all other living beings, and to reciprocate it especially by being able to lead them on the path through having actualized the path first ourselves. And so cultivate that bodhicitta motivation. The thing about precious human life is you could see even at the time of the Buddha there were beings who were born who had absolutely no interest in his teachings, or who met the Buddha and just, oh, nice guy. Or some of them didn't even say nice guy. So you can really see how what sentient beings experience in their life is so much due to their own karma, their own mindset. And so since our karma and our mindset, these are all conditioned phenomena, it's important to deliberately condition them in a certain way while we have that opportunity, and not just say, oh, well, here I am living my life. Yeah, Dharma's here, very good. Yeah, Abby's here, very nice. Oh, yeah, there's some Dharma books. I'll get around to reading them. But by remembering that we're going to die, to really take this whole thing seriously. And so I think that means pulling ourselves out of, somewhat pulling ourselves out of this conception we have of being the person that we think we are. Because we think we are this, person, whatever your name is. You think, I'm that person, and this is my situation, and this is who I am, and I always will be this person. But we always won't be this person. Yeah? Aggregates change, lifetime to lifetime. And so what aggregates, you know, I happens to be, the continuum of this I happens to be labeled upon in future lives is dependent upon what we do now. So, you know, putting things in the perspective of many lifetimes, I think, is really quite essential to practicing the path over a long period of time. You know, you can benefit from Buddhist teachings without believing in rebirth, but I think, you know, my experience has been anyway, that to really have the energy to go deeper, you need to think of what's beyond this life. Because if there's only this life, then yeah, heck, you know, have some problems, kill yourself, it's all over. Yeah? Nothing makes any sense. Not from the perspective of, you know, multiple lifetimes, we come to understand a little bit of why we're born who we are, why we experience what we experience, you know, and we can take the care to condition our mind in this life so that we'll have increasingly better opportunities in future lives to be able to practice. Monastic vows is one big way to do it because, you know, the cause of just getting a human aggregates is keeping pure ethical discipline. So, and there's different levels of ethical discipline, of course. But when you take precepts, every moment that you're not breaking them, you're accumulating the good karma of keeping them. So, you know, for example, two people might be sitting in the room and neither of them, hopefully, are killing anybody at that time. Yeah. But one has vows and one doesn't. And the person who has, you know, the vow not to kill, they're not killing, so they are actively keeping their vow. They're actively according their actions with their intention not to kill. Even if that intention isn't something manifest in their mind at that time, by the power of the vows, that intention is there, and so they're always accumulating the good karma of abandoning killing. Whereas the other person who doesn't have the vow or the precept, they're sitting in the room also not killing, but they're not living up to any intention at that time because they haven't set that strong intention through the taking of the precept. Okay. So that's why ordination, one of the great benefits of ordination is that there's this constant accumulation of good karma, of merit or positive potential. That happens, you know, even you're sitting somewhere, even you're sleeping, you know, even you're spaced out. I'm not condoning being spaced out, but if you have precepts, at least you're accumulating some good karma. As long as you're not spaced out daydreaming of, you know, sex and killing people and things like that. Okay. So, you know, that's one of the big benefits, I think, of keeping the precepts. And, of course, the more precepts you have, then the more good karma you create. So, you know, the different levels of ordination have different numbers of precepts, and so you have more responsibility as you take more precepts, but you also get more benefit from them. And another one of the major benefits of precepts is that it helps us stop the habit of doing these negative karmas. And the habit, you know, when we talk about the result of karma, how we sometimes talk of three, you know, the maturation result, which is the rebirth, and then the result that concords with the action, and then the environmental result. Well, the result that concords with the action, the result that concords with the cause, there's various ways of translating it. I haven't gotten them all down yet. But that has two kinds of result. One, where what you experience accords with the experience you made other people have. And the other part of that is your future experience concords with your habitual energy to do the action again. Okay? And so that karmic result, you know, the result of habitually doing the action again, is perhaps the worst one of the karmic results. Because even the maturation result, you're born in the hell realm and that karma is over.
Mm.
But with this other one, you know, even you're born in a good rebirth, you have this tendency to continue to do the negative action again and again and again and again and again. And so you just have this tendency to accumulate greater and greater and greater negative karma. So by taking precepts, what you're doing, you know, because the precept is such a strong intention to stop doing those actions, it's a very strong opposing factor for that karmic result, which is the karmic result of doing the action again habitually. Okay? And so taking the precepts safeguards us from, you know, just even let's say being born human and having the tendency to drink and steal people's stuff and sleep around and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very strong for purification in that way as well. Okay, so, you know, the precepts benefit us so much karmically by purifying, you know, that karmic result, by creating positive potential. And then through that, creating the cause for a good rebirth where we can continue to do that. And then, of course, that the benefits that we talked about the first day in terms of pacifying the mind so that we can concentrate better and then from that being able to gain wisdom. And that thing about pacifying the mind so we can concentrate, you know, we may not realize it, but, you know, after you meditate a while, we begin to see how, what comes up in our meditation, and very often a lot of regret comes up. You know, just regret for actions that we've done in the past, times when we haven't been very nice to people. And mostly we're just remembering stuff this life, but who knows what in the world we did in previous lives that is going to come up later as our concentration improves. But even this lifetime, sometimes it's pretty horrific to think of what we've done. Okay? And so we spend a good deal of time in our meditation dealing with regret, you know, which is a healthy attitude in the sense of it's one of the four opponent powers and it leads us to do purification. But then the unhealthy form of regret is guilt. Okay, and we can spend enormous amounts of meditation time feeling guilty, you know, because we lack the ability to discriminate between regret and guilt. And so since we are professionals in feeling guilty, you know, it easily comes. Especially those who grew up Jewish or Catholic, we have a monopoly on feeling guilty. We once had a contest in one of the retreats I led. We had discussion groups according to religion of origin. The Jews and the Catholics were neck and neck, and who felt the guiltiest? We won. Jews, 4,000 years of feeling guilty, you know. Catholics only had 2,000 years of it. Okay, but you begin to see how much time we can spend beating ourselves up. Yeah, and how useless it is. Yeah, especially when we can't tell the difference between guilt and regret. Yeah, because then we might even think we're doing something virtuous by feeling guilty, and we're not. Okay, because there's this one corner of our mind that thinks the more I feel guilty and the worse I feel, then somehow I'm atoning for the negative actions I've done. Okay, that's more the Catholic thing. The Jews don't have that much take. We just feel guilty because it's what you're supposed to do. You know, 4,000 years of history, you don't have a choice, you know. But the Catholics really do the one of you know, if I'm guilty, then I'm purifying, I'm atoning, you know. So beat, okay. And you know, Protestants can get into that a bit too. Catholics don't have a monopoly, nor do the Jews. And, you know, probably the born-again Christians, I would assume, you know, some good deal of training in guilt, don't you think? Yeah. So, you know, we can even think we're doing something virtuous. You know, thinking that the more I make myself feel lousy because I hate myself and feel guilty, then the more I'm atoning. This is the kind of logic our mind has. Okay? Totally illogical, isn't it? Yeah. How does making ourselves feel lousy do anything for anybody? Doesn't. Okay? So, what I'm getting at is we can waste or spend a great deal of time that where we could be meditating, but instead we're feeling guilty and hating ourselves and this kind of stuff. If we keep good ethical discipline, then there's nothing to feel guilty and regret. Okay? So we save ourselves all of that headache because we don't have so many, you know, bad feelings about things that we've done in the past. And so while it is important, you know, when we meditate and this stuff comes up, we have to look at it and understand it and then make a firm determination not to do it again. And you can see that, you know, so many of those actions that we're making firm determinations not to do again are the same actions that we take precepts not to do. Okay, so you can really see the beneficial aspect of the precepts here. Okay? Okay, so we're going to continue on from, that was introduction. continue on from yesterday, talking a little bit about the history of the Sangha. You know, so we were talking yesterday how, you know, in the Vedic society at the time, there was the priestly caste of the Brahmins, and then there were the other religious beings, the Samanas, who, you know, were comprised of various different wandering sects, people who had renounced householder life and, you know, lived simply. And that there was a great variety of different kind of samanas. It's quite interesting when you read the Pali Canon because you really see the Buddha dialoguing with all these different people. And sometimes he dialogues with the Brahmins, and it's interesting that the Brahmins will come and sometimes seek the Buddha out and ask him questions, and they're usually quite respectful towards him and he towards them. But, you know, in so many of the sutras, what he's doing is correcting their wrong views. And then in other sutras, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha is meeting with people from other sects. Who, you know, are these other samanas. And it's very interesting because usually they are depicted as being so raucous. I mean, there's a portion at the beginning of the sutra, you know, the Buddha has the idea to go see so-and-so, you know, samana. And as he approaches the group where that samana and his disciples are living in the forest, they hear yelling and screaming and laughter and carrying on and, you know, just like everybody's let loose. And then, of course, when they see the Buddha, they all kind of look very proper. So that's kind of like us, you know. We kind of carry on and we're laughing at our behaviors all over the place. And then as soon as the teacher's there, so, we're so quiet and sincere. So, but many of the sutras are like that. You know, and then the Buddha will, sometimes those people will come and see the Buddha. Sometimes the Buddha will just, you know, with his clairvoyant powers decide that he's going to go and talk to them. And they usually wind up talking about views, you know, because there was so much philosophical debate at the time of the Buddha about various questions. And, you know, so there's sort of diversity in views. And it's interesting because, you know, when we talk about true path, the fourth noble truth, you know, what is included in that is the three higher trainings. And another way to divide the three higher trainings is into the noble eightfold path because the eight can all be included in the three. When we list out the noble eightfold path, the first one is correct view. Yeah. And it's interesting because when we talk about the three principal aspects of the path, correct view is the last one. Yeah. So it makes you think, well, why? Why in the Noble Eightfold Path? It's the first one. And my conclusion, okay, is, you know, through reading this and seeing how the Buddha is debating with all these other ascetics and wanderers at the time, is that without a correct intellectual view of what is suffering, what causes suffering, what is moksha or liberation, and what is the path, without a correct intellectual view of the Four Noble Truths, you don't even set out on the correct path to start with. Okay? So, you know, without having just the worldview that the Dharma sets out, it becomes very difficult to really progress on the path. So, for example, at the time of the Buddha, there was one sect that were total hedonists or nihilists. And they said, you know, there's no rebirth, there's no enlightenment, there's no karma, things just happen by chance. They're random events. Okay? These people sound very much like today's scientists. It's kind of the worldview of science. You know, it's just kind of random. Except science goes a step further and says, mind is just a function of brain. Everything can be reduced, you know, to material things that are measurable by scientific instruments. At least the ones at the time of the Buddha didn't have that view. Okay. Yeah, but there's a similarity. You can see some similarity in views. Well, if you have that view, that there's no past, future life, there's no karma, there's no enlightenment, there's no cause and effect, things happen accidentally, by chance, randomly, then are you going to have any motivation to practice the path? No. You'll have absolutely no interest in practicing the path, because the path is all about causes and effect, and what kind of causes lead to what kind of effects. So if you don't even believe in that to start with, and if you think that when you die it's all over, you know, finished, you're not going to practice anything. You're just going to enjoy life. So you can see how just a correct intellectual view is so important for the start of the path. Okay? Or there were other people at the time of the Buddha who had the view, all sorts of very interesting views about what the path was. Now, because there were all the naked, matted hair ascetics. Yeah, that thought if you walked around naked, and if you, there were some that they thought if you acted like a dog now, you used up your karma to be reborn as a dog. You know? And so, I mean, and the Pali Canon talks about these people, you know, people who are walking around on all fours, human beings, walking around on all fours, scouring the garbage for things, you know. They won't lift the food they find with their hand up to their mouth. They stick their head down and eat it. I mean, all just sorts of weird ideas about Lyle's looking like me. Yeah, it's pretty weird, isn't it? But you can see that if people have wrong views, you know, this is what they think is going to lead them to some kind of upper rebirth or liberation. And apparently there were other people sometime in Indian history that believed that if you jumped on a trident and the center spoke of the trident came out the crown of your head, you attain liberation. Yeah. And then, I mean, who's this guy? There's one guy who's very popular nowadays who teaches people to walk on hot coals. What's his name? Is it Anthony or somebody?
Anthony Robbins.
Yeah, something like that. You know, you walk on coals and you get special, you know, something. And, you know, but you can see it's just the wrong views towards ethical discipline. And you wind up creating negative karma, thinking that you're creating positive karma. Okay? Or the Brahmins of that time, many of the Brahmins did animal sacrifice. And you find even in Nepal nowadays, one time in the autumn, were you there?
Was that happen?
I've been there when they do it, and it's horrible. You know, all these sheep and goats, and they just herd them along and, you know, slit their throats and, you know, offer them to the gods, and this is the way you propitiate the gods. In Malaysia, you know, a lot of the Taoists, what they call Taoism, it's not the real Taoism, you know, that came from China, but what the people call Taoism, it's kind of folk religion, they'll do animal sacrifices. Okay, so if you have this kind of view, you know, wrong view about ethics, wrong view about what the path is, then you create incredible negative karma thinking you're creating positive karma. Yeah, so you can really see, you know, just at the beginning why having a correct view is so important and why the Buddha spent so much time talking to the Brahmins and talking to the people from these different renunciate groups in an attempt to, you know, bring them onto the correct path by having the correct view. And so, you know, he would debate them very often, but the source of debate started right at the time of the Buddha. Okay. And so then you think, well, why then in the three principal aspects of the path is correct view the last one? Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, I think the Lam Rim presupposes that people have been brought up in a Buddhist culture where they have that worldview, okay? And where they have a lot of that already. They already believe in rebirth and karma. There's some knowledge of the Buddha and so on. Because in the Lam Rim, correct view is referring to what you're trying to get is not just the correct intellectual view of the Four Noble Truths, but you're trying to get direct perception of emptiness. So it's, you know, it's a little bit, it's focusing on view meaning the direct perception of emptiness, not just the world view. Okay. Because it's presupposing that you have the worldview, which of course Westerners don't. Yeah. And I think that's why His Holiness nowadays, if you go to His Holiness's teachings in the West, what does He start off teaching? Two truths and four noble truths, so that people can have that worldview. Okay. Anyway, it's quite interesting, you know, how the Buddha will go around and talk with these different people. There's some of the people who are hold very, very rigidly to their own beliefs and who are seeking magical powers. And in fact, they think the magical powers are liberation or some sort of spiritual accomplishment. And in Buddhism, you know, it says that, you know, you can get magical powers or clairvoyant powers from having the higher training of concentration. But you don't even need the realization of emptiness to do that. And in some cases, you don't even need pure ethical discipline to have those kind of, you know, clairvoyant powers. For example, in the story of Milarepa, I mean, he had clairvoyant powers, but, you know, he killed 35 of his relatives. So, you know, sometimes the Buddha would be in situations where these people he couldn't really discuss with them philosophical views because that isn't what would convince them. And so he would have to engage in contests of miraculous powers. And in fact, of the four holy days, the four special days in the Buddhist calendar for the Tibetans, I think it might be different in the other Buddhist traditions, the one that is the full moon of the first month, the first lunar month. The history of that is that there were some, you know, ascetics who challenged the Buddha to a contest of miraculous powers. And the Buddha said, no, you know, this has nothing to do with the spiritual path. And, you know, kept avoiding these people and just saying no. And then finally they were so persistent that he said, okay. And so then he showed his miraculous powers, which of course far outshone theirs, and they all converted. And the whole way, yeah. So, you know, that in general, you know, actually part of our precepts are not to show any kind of powers. So people who have powers are not allowed to show them, except in very special occasions. You know, you'll see that happening. Or I haven't seen it happen, but you hear of it happening, you know, in the past with these great tantric adepts. You know, sometimes they would show their powers because people wouldn't believe in any other, you know, way. But in general, it's, you know, it's not allowed. Nor is it allowed to proclaim one's own realizations. Okay, and if one falsely proclaims realizations, it's a root downfall of your monastic vows. And even if it's true that you have those realizations, if you proclaim them, it's still an infraction of one of the lapses, the pious tika vows. Okay, so, but sometimes, you know, the Buddha, because of the circumstance, like he would say, I'm a fully enlightened one, or I'm a Tathagata, or he would do those magical powers. That was, I think, a special exception for the case of the Buddha because of the environment that he lived in. But he, you know, really discouraged his disciples from doing it. But there's this act of interchange, you know, amongst all these various groups debating different philosophies. And so a number of the people who joined the Sangha came from these other wandering groups, because what would happen is if their leader and the Buddha had a discussion and the Buddha was, you know, proved that their philosophy was incorrect, then that leader would convert, and so all 500, they usually had 500. 500 just means a lot. You know, don't take it literally as 500. It just means a lot, you know. And so all of his disciples would also convert and become Buddhist. So you have these stories of all the, you know, the matted hair ascetics. So, and in India, there's still matted hair ascetics. I mean, in America, there's matted hair, but they're not ascetics. So you cut off your hair and shave your beard and, you know, put on the robes and go for it. So in the Sangha, you have this wide, wide variety of people coming from many different backgrounds and many different castes. Okay? It wasn't just Brahmins. It wasn't just the social elite who renounced. Okay? And it wasn't just, you know, the flaky people in society who renounced. It was everybody, you know? Because the Buddha contacted, and I think this is one of the beautiful things about the teachers, you know, his life story, is he taught very poor people, very rich people. He taught people who, you know, earn their living from wrong livelihood and people who earn their living from right livelihood. He taught everybody. Yeah? And so I think that's a very good example for us. The Buddha didn't just go out and teach the rich people who would donate stuff to him and his community. He taught everybody. Okay? And so you have this community that is full of all different kinds of people who in ordinary life would never live together, never even speak together. Because remember, you know, the caste system in India is, you know, such very rigid social system and social roles. And yet the Buddha forbade the keeping of any aspects of the caste system within his Sangha. Okay? And so it may be one of the reasons why when you get ordained, you sit according to your age of ordination, how long you've been ordained. And so not according to the social class that you belong to when you renounce, because you cut your hair, you shave your beard for the guys, you change your clothes, everybody looks alike. And everybody needs to act alike and respect each other alike. Okay. I was very shocked when I was talking with one of my teachers one time, and he said, and I don't know how this snuck into it, but he said people of the butcher class could not ordain. And I think that this, I don't know if it snuck in India or in Tibet, you know, because none of this happened at the time of the Buddha. There were people from all different backgrounds.
But one of those long list of questions they ask you when you were dating, mm-hmm. you as a cobbler.
Yeah.
Like that's
right. And I'm wondering if that came in afterwards. You know,
yeah,
because remember the Vinaya was codified after the Buddha passed away. And actually for many centuries, and people added things and so on. So, you know, stuff could have kept in later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the time of the Buddha, you know, he was really very clear about, you know, no caste system. So I think that must have been quite interesting, having these people who had been socialized in a certain way all of a sudden have to get unsocialized because you couldn't flout your caste on anybody. And so similarly nowadays, I think when people ordain, you know, as Dharma spreads, hopefully we will get people from all different sorts of backgrounds coming. And, you know, often when you know, when you're a layperson, when you look at the Sangha, it's kind of, okay, they all basically look alike, you know, different sizes and shapes, but all bald and wearing, you know, robes. And you think, oh, they must all think alike because they all have the same philosophical views and so on. Well, when you live in the Sangha, you realize that people think very, very differently. Yeah. And when you're living in a Sangha community, you're living with people who you probably wouldn't even speak to in your regular social life. Because, I mean, even in America, as much as we say, you know, we're a classless society and so on, we have very rigid social classes in our country. Okay? And even people from the same class, you know, have different ways of doing things. Like I was saying, you know, we all go in the kitchen and we all see what our mothers were like, you know, because we just, you know, we were trained to be in a kitchen in a different way. And so there's all different sorts of things and all these people coming together. And then Vinaya is kind of like the body of guidelines or the body of agreements that keeps everybody in harmony so that they can all live together. So we're working not only on our ethical discipline, but we're also working on a lot of our little habits. You know, the glass is right side up and the glass is upside down. And there's no vow about that one. But when you get into, you know, a lot of the details of the Vinaya and the Pratimoksha precepts, you know, you see that a lot of there's a lot of details about different things. And of course, some of them may apply to our living condition now, and some don't, you know, like the kind of material that you use to stuff your mattress or how many layers of straw you can put on your roof. but still, you know, there you can see that it's an attempt to get everybody all on the same page, you know, so that people don't flout their previous background. Also, of course, as you got more and more people ordaining, people who ordained who didn't have good motivation started coming in the Sangha. So, for example, at one time, there was one doctor, Dr. Jiveka, I think. Am I pronouncing his name right? Jiveka. He offered free medical service to all the Sangha, you know, because he had so much respect for the Buddha. And so after that, a number of people who were ill ordained so that they could get free medical service from Dr. Jivaka. So then a precept came into being that you can't ordain if you're very ill or if you're severely handicapped because they didn't want people ordaining with the wrong motivation. Okay. But you can see even at the time of the Buddha, this kind of stuff started happening. Okay, so the Sangha was basically, you know, wandering around from place to place. You know, when you read the Pali Canon, you see that the schedule of the day was usually you got up, you did a little bit of practice, then you did some walking meditation to collect alms, yeah, came back, ate your meal before noon, and then retired to the forest where you didn't retire like we do for our afternoon nap, but where you retire to sit at the base of a tree and do your meditation practice. And then as evening came around and it was cooler, then you would alternate walking meditation and sitting meditation and walking and sitting. Okay? And so the discourses that the Buddha gave and the discussions he had with other religious-minded people at that time usually happened in the afternoon when they were all, you know, in a grove, you know, after their main meal. Okay, so, you know, we talked yesterday about just the basic way that they got the four requisites, food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. The Buddha also talked about, for those who wanted to do a more ascetic practice, he talked about 12 ascetic practices. So I think these are kind of interesting to look at. Okay, so this 12 austere practices, in terms of shelter, in a place that's secluded, okay, so not in a town, but in a place where you're off alone. And so for societies where there was a big belief in ghosts, this was often a big challenge. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not ghosts, but maybe deer or bear, you know. So, what?
Tigers.
Yeah. You know, so living in a place that was secluded. Then living beneath trees was an austere practice. Living in graveyards. Yeah. And so that again allows our superstitious mind to arise. It's quite interesting. You know, how do you feel when you go in a graveyard? Do you have this feeling that, ooh, there's all these spirits hanging around, or, ooh, it's about death, and, if I'm near death, I might die, and you know, I mean, we have a lot of namtok. Namtok is kind of a word for superstitious thought or preconception. Now, how do we feel about graveyards? Okay, sleeping in graveyards. Actually, that's where they found a lot of the discarded cloth that they used for their robes. Was in graveyards. How do you feel wearing the clothing of somebody who died? And then in a place that's roofless, where you're exposed to the elements. So remember, this was in ancient India. Our condition is a little bit different. Okay, then in terms for a bed, you would sleep cross-legged, not lying down. And actually the monastics at City of 10,000 Buddhas, that's what they do. They don't lie down. And some people, when they do long retreats, like Tenzin Palmo, when she was doing long retreats, she had her box and didn't lie down. Or using grass as a mattress. For people with allergies, that's going to be a bad one. Okay, for food, then you collect alms. You know, you don't grow food and do agriculture. So this was one of the reasons why the Buddha stipulated that the Sangha didn't grow their own food, didn't engage in agriculture, didn't plow the ground and dig the earth. Okay. Eating one meal a day. And sometimes, like in Thailand, they still call it one meal a day, but they actually eat two meals a day. They actually eat breakfast and they eat lunch, but they say they eat one meal a day. Okay, and another ascetic practice would be to only go to three homes, you know, and if nobody gave you after three homes, then that was it. And then to eat only what you receive the first time, you know. So sometimes there's the practice of going on the alms round and collecting food. And then you go back to where you were before, to your monastery, and some people have brought food there. So some people, for an ascetic practice, they'll eat only what they were given when they're going around. They won't eat what is brought to the monastery. Or if they don't go out on Pindapat, they'll eat only what's brought to the monastery. Okay. Then in terms of clothes, wearing rags and having your three robes. And then it said felt cloth. So I'm not sure. That must be some particular kind of cloth. I don't know if felt is the... It's probably not what we think of as felt, but maybe some very rough, scratchy cloth. cloth, something like that. Okay, now that's not all the sangha, the practice goes, but you know, if people wanted to do a more austere practice, that's what they did. And there's one of the sutras where, actually, I think it was one of the ascetics, they were asking the Buddha about this, because according to them, you know, living an extremely ascetic life and, you know, not having any kind of anything was the way, you know, to subdue the lust and the energy in the body. And the Buddha, in counteracting that view, you know, was saying, well, yes, of course, you know, some of my disciples also do ascetic practices. But he said, look at my life. You know, some of my disciples are more ascetic than I am. And he very freely admitted that. Yeah. So the, I mean, I found it a very interesting sutra because, you know, some of his disciples, maybe they would keep silence or they would, you know, never go in town or they would, you know, do all sorts of very, you know, much more austere practices. But the Buddha would say, well, you know, that's it. That alone is not what gets you to realizations, because look at me, you know, I'm talking all day with different people who come to see me. And, you know, what also began to happen is that people, wealthy people, would invite the Buddha and the Sangha to their homes and offer food. And you know, it's actually very touching how this happened. And they would prepare all sorts of delicacies and so on. And then these very rich people would offer food to the Buddha and the Sangha themselves, putting it in their bowls themselves, rather than have their servants do it, or rather than have, you know, a buffet style. And I think it's very touching to see the kind of respect that people had for the Sangha at that time, and, you know, even the way these wealthy people kind of saw the Sangha as an object of reverence and as a field that you use to create merit, and so would make offerings like this. And so it also happened that after the Yarne or Vasa, the rainy seasons retreat, at the end of that, then the lay people would often offer cloth, because that was one occasion where you could offer new cloth, and, you know, instead of them picking up rags and have it stitched and made into robes. Okay, so, you know, gradually what happened was, you know, the thing of people coming to the Buddha, to the Sangha, to offer, or asking them to their homes. Yeah. And so you really see that in America there needs to be a great deal of education about this. Yeah, because we tend to, in Dharma centers, you know, the Sangha is kind of the cheap labor, and if you can get to the food line before they can and serve yourself and take the best parts, you do that. And, you know, but it's really something to be aware of and mindful in our practice. And the reason that these people respected the Sangha was not because of the people themselves, but because they held the vows that the Buddha gave, and because they were keeping pure ethical discipline. Okay, so what is really being respected is the vows and the practice. And when you think about it that way, then it becomes possible to show respect to Sangha members, because you do admire the precepts that they've taken and the way that they're living in strict ethical discipline. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it's still, most of you being lay people, that's something to keep in mind. And even when you're ordained, you still show respect to the Sangha. I was telling Venerable Choki the other day that I think one of the things that happens in Western Sangha is that when the people are lay people, they'll somewhat respect the Sangha, but then as soon as they ordain, they say, well, we're all kind of equal, and so no need to respect the Sangha anymore. And when the Sangha doesn't respect the Sangha, then of course the lay people aren't going to respect the Sangha either. Yeah. And it's something very touching when you go to Shasta Abbey, for example. They use the title Reverend, you know. So everybody is Reverend so-and-so, and they use Reverend when they talk to each other. You know, in Tibetan tradition, we kind of, you know, hey, Tashi, you know, how you doing? But you know, I think what happens is even in our own mind, when we treat people who have precepts or people who have spiritual accomplishments with respect, then it opens our mind to develop those same realizations or that same kind of practice. Okay? So that's why even there might be some monk or nun that you don't like very much, but you still show respect because they have the precepts. This doesn't mean that you lavishly, you know, kind of kowtow to anything and that they can boss you around and snap their fingers and tell you what to do. No. You know, if you're working on a project together, you still discuss the project and you voice your opinions and things like that. Okay? So you have to understand what respecting the Sangha means. It doesn't mean that, you know, somebody becomes like a dictator over everybody else. I mean, that's certainly not good for their mind or your mind. Yeah, so when you work together, you know, you share your expertise, your qualities, you all discuss together. Okay. And from the side of the Sangha, you know, we're taught very much that when people show respect, to remember that the respect isn't directed towards us, that it's directed towards the precepts. Because if you receive respect and then you get conceited and arrogant because of it, then your own practice degenerates. So when you receive respect because, you know, people bow, then you visualize the Buddha at your heart or the Buddha on your head, and you think that the people are bowing or offering to the Buddha. Okay? And so you remember it's not you, so you don't accumulate some big ego. But this process is really, there's something quite, quite important about it, you know, that it took me a number of years to realize. And I know when I'm in Asia, like in Singapore, you know, because it's part of their culture, like if I give a public talk and then afterwards I'll sit outside, some people will come and they'll come and make prostrations and make offering. And at first, you're going, but, you know, there's something quite beautiful that can happen at that moment because when people are bowing, I mean, I'm aware it has nothing to do with me, you know. It's simply the Sangha and it's the precepts, you know. It's the Buddha who gave the precepts that they're showing the respect to. I just happen to be a representative at that time. But then, you know, you think of yourself as Chenrezig or Tara, and you radiate light to that person as they're bowing, you know, and then they make an offering, and you rejoice that they're creating good karma when they make the offering. And you can see, you know, you look at their mental state, you know, the people who just kind of leave the hall and walk by and, you know, don't even say anything, and the people who stop and make prostrations and make an offering. And you can see that there's definitely something virtuous going on in their mind that isn't going on in the minds of the other people who didn't take that opportunity. You know? And so at first when I lived in Singapore, I had the same reaction you did. It was like, ooh. And, you know, and when the people would call me venerable, it was like I was terribly embarrassed because I had come from India and we never called each other. We never used titles at all. And, you know, and when some of those people first came with me to India, I remember saying, don't call me venerable in front of my friends. My friends would think I'm very arrogant. And they said, well, don't worry, we'll call them venerable also. Because they said they're monks and nuns. We should call them venerable. You know, they are. We should call them with a title. I mean, they just had such a beautiful view that way. And, you know, so you can really see that when people have that in their mind, they take the opportunity to create merit. And that merit definitely benefits their mind. And it's, you know, and it's not part of our culture, but what it did for me is it made me look at, you know, what my culture is like and how disrespectful my culture is. I mean, like just, you see people driving down the road, we're so discourteous in cars, unbelievable, or in lines, you know, just really discourteous. But how much it changes the mind when you show respect and when you take the opportunity to make an offering, you know. And sometimes it's just very small offerings, but just people taking that chance, you know, that opportunity. Or sometimes they offer a lot, and the thing is, when they offer, they don't even have their name on it, usually. Sometimes they'll have their name on the envelope, sometimes they won't. You don't even know who gave it. But you always dedicate for them, whoever they are. And you see that, you know, they're really giving with a pure mind. They're not giving so that you know they're the ones who give, you know, $500 or something. You know, they're just giving because giving feels good, or showing respect because, you know, they know it benefits their mind. And, you know, and so from you as a sangha, I mean, I really had to get over this whole thing of feeling embarrassed about it and learn to respect, you know, to accept it and to see that it has nothing to do with me as a human being. No. But it definitely becomes a mindfulness practice, because sometimes if you live in a society where people treat you very respectfully, then when you come back to America, you know, it's like you're really shocked and you're not, you know, you're not quite sure what to do or how to be, because sometimes, I mean, of course people who aren't Buddhists, if they treat you disrespectfully, I mean, you kind of accept that, you know, if they say Hare Krishna or whatever, you smile at them. I mean, that's nothing unusual. That's okay, you know. But sometimes what's quite surprising is when you're with other Buddhists, you know, people who've been practicing, and they're very, you know, they never stop to think of the Sangha as a merit field. Their teacher, yes, but not the Sangha as a whole. And I think they really miss out on something, you know. And the Buddha, there's a very beautiful sutra in the Pali Canon. It's one of the ones I put on your reading list, where there is somebody who wants to make offerings to the Sangha. I can't remember if it was a laywoman or a nun. She wanted to make offerings. No, she wanted to make offerings to the Buddha. And the Buddha very clearly said, no, make offerings to the Sangha, because the Sangha is a higher object of merit than I am, the Buddha said. Why? Because so many of the Sangha of his time were arhats. And so if you offer to the Sangha, even offering a meal to the Sangha, or offering, you know, to a park to the Sangha, something that was used by all of the Sangha, then definitely there were some arhats there. Yeah, and so you were offering to beings with, you know, the highest realizations, and you were offering to beings who, even if they weren't arhats, were keeping pure ethical discipline. And so you weren't just offering to one person who was the Buddha, but to many, many, many of them. Yeah. So that's why they say, like in Dharamsala, when His Holiness teaches, they have a time when they pass out food, or pass out, usually it's tea, and sometimes money offerings to the Sangha. And so they say it's very good to make offerings at that time. There's one central place where you can go and make your offerings, because if you make offerings there and then it's distributed amongst all of the Sangha, for sure you're going to be offering to some realized beings. You know, at the most and at least, you know, people who are keeping precepts. Yeah, so I was quite touched when I read that sutra. You know, how the Buddha really emphasized that. Yes, but living here in the West, you just have to be able to accept whatever happens, because people treat you all sorts of ways, and you can't assume that just even because they're Buddhist that they know how to treat the Sangha. You know, or even they may know, they may not want to, because it really has to do. I mean, we can all look in our own minds with humbling ourselves a little bit, doesn't it? And, you know, who likes to let somebody else go first in the food line? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or who likes to wash somebody else's dishes? Or who likes to, you know, any number of things. So it's, but we can see precisely why it's a good practice for us. Yeah, because it involves humbling ourselves, and it also involves opening our eyes to other people and what they're doing and what they may need at any particular time. And so also within the Sangha, there's the tradition of the juniors taking care of the seniors. You know? And again, it's the same kind of thing. And it's a reciprocal relationship. It's not just that the lay people serve the Sangha or that the juniors serve the seniors, but it's the reciprocal thing of, if, in terms of the lay and the Sangha, that the Sangha then teaches, you know? And so you give teachings, and you give counseling, and you give guidance, and you set a good example, you know? And they say that the gift of the Dharma is the highest giving, the highest gift. And so people may give you a banana, but you give them the Dharma. And so that's part of the reciprocal relationship. So you don't go, oh, well, I'm too busy to teach, and, you know, you sit and drink tea and, you know, relax. But definitely, you know, there's a commitment to give what you have to share. And it's not only teachings, you know. You shouldn't be a sangha and say, well, I'm just going to teach, you know, I can't do any other work. But you also, you know, especially when you're living in a monastic community, everybody pitches in and helps according to their own ability. And between the juniors and the seniors, you know, it's the same thing, you know, when you're junior and when, you know, you offer respect to seniors or you serve the seniors. It's a way, you know, because you can see people who've been ordained a lot, they've gone through a lot, you know, and there's something to respect in them. Now, you might say, you know, and I've heard people say this, those funny stories, you know, somebody coming and say, oh, this one nun, you know, and if you've been around, you know who they must be talking about. You know, this one nun is so angersome, you know, she's just so difficult and so quarrelsome. Really hard to get along, and she's one of the older Sangha, and how come, you know, she's been one of the people ordained the longest, and she's still so quarrelsome, doesn't the Dharma work? And the person's reply was, you should have known her before. You know? So, you know, even the Dharma does work, and you do see people improving. And, you know, just even recently, I was talking with one friend of mine who is, you know, she's on the junior level of the Sangha, and we were talking about one senior member and how he has incredible suffering, you know, one monk, just incredible suffering and, you know, very easily irritated and things like that. You can really see his suffering. But we were both really remarking how, in spite of his suffering, he remained ordained. And in spite of his difficulty with anger and irritation and getting frustrated when people didn't do what he wanted them to do and stuff like that, he stayed ordained. And we were both expressing a great deal of reverence for the fact that he did that, you know, because other people, when they have difficulty with anger or attachment, they just say, oh, my ordination is the problem, and they disrobe and they go off. Okay, but this monk hung in there, and it wasn't easy, but we both really respected, and we were commenting on that to each other, how he hung in there all those years and really kept practicing and kept his vows. Yeah? So you can see, even if it's somebody who you may not like or who has some, you know, has some faults, still, you know, you can see that they're doing some practice. And you can find something to respect there. Yeah? And so it's really a matter of training your mind. Because I often tell the story about how when I was first ordained, you know, we're sitting in ordination lineage. I mean, of course, I started off at the end of the line, but then after a few years, you're kind of, you know, you've advanced a little bit. There's people newly ordained down. And you would look up the line, or I would look up the line, and I would find, you know, with every senior person who was senior to me, I could find a fault. You know, this one does this, and this one does that, and that one does this, and this one does this. And, of course, you're always sitting by the ones you like the least, you know. This one. Oh, you know. And then, and the further on down the line, the ones who are juniors, and they're so raucous, and they're so ill-behaved, and they're so discouraged. Yeah. And you can find fault with every single one of them, you know. And I remember, you know, in the early years of my ordination, I mean, I was an expert. You know, I told you my opinion factory works overtime. I can find, you know, extra faults anytime with anybody, you know, just give me the opportunity. And what I really found is after some time, you know, through practicing the Dharma and through understanding the value of generating respect for people's good qualities and respect for the ordination, I began to notice that when I looked up the line at the people who were senior, and granted they had more time to practice by this time because I was also, you know, older in my ordination. But wow, this one does this, and this one does that, and that one does this. And, you know, they all have talents and abilities that I don't have. And, you know, wow, you know, really respecting them. And then looking down the line at the juniors, and wow, this one has such incredible potential here, and this one's, you know, really trying there, and that one, you know, can, you know, they can really do something good. And, you know, and you watch your own mind change to be able to show respect and see people's good qualities and not always focus on the faults. Okay. Now, that wasn't what I was going to talk about. But, you know, I mean, these are the same issues that came up. I'm tying it back in. You know, it came up historically. So I started saying about how people would invite the Sangha and then make offerings to them, and that whole practice of showing respect, and, you know, and how it's still very much part of the practice nowadays, and why it's done, and then how you think when people offer you respect. Yeah. And if people give you things, you don't just take them and hoard them and keep them yourself. You know, oh, I must be really good, all these people are giving me presents. But then you recycle them, you know. And this is actually something I found so nice when I lived in Singapore, because whenever people came, you know, to visit or, you know, for a private appointment or counseling or ask Dharma questions, they would always bring some kind of offering. And so then I had a lot of things around, and I had things that I could give the other people who came, you know. And then, of course, they felt so happy when they received a gift. And it was really a very nice kind of thing to be able to do. Yeah. So I think slowly, you know, our culture hopefully will kind of imbibe this. And even if the entire culture doesn't, at least, you know, the Buddhist, you know, minority can. And it sets a good example, you know, because it spills over into other areas of your life too. When you go visit your parents, then you're also more respectful and courteous with your parents. You know, and that makes a big difference in your family relationships. Okay, we've gone over time, but if you have a few questions, maybe. Yeah?
Can you say a little bit more about these sort of Tibetan precepts and how you can just be sitting on the couch? You know, reading the Dharma book, right? Uh-huh. Accumulating, like, what it actually is that.
Okay. Why is
a mechanism, you know, like how it works.
How it works.
Yeah.
So the mechanism, how it works, that you're sitting on the couch reading a Dharma book and you're accumulating all this good karma from keeping precepts. Okay. Well, there's different ways of defining karma. You know, some schools say that it's what's something called non-revelatory form. It's a type of form. And some say that it's the mental factor of intention. Okay. But if you go according to the thing of it being the mental factor of intention, let's say you've taken the precept to not kill. Okay. You have that intention, you take that precept, and that intent, that precept is kind of like the continuation of that intention. Okay? So even though that intention may not be grossly manifest, you're not thinking at that moment, I don't want to kill. You know, there's some kind of continuation of that intention. And you have that precept, that vow to abandon that behavior. And so as long as your behavior is in accordance with that intention that you set, then you are keeping that precept and living according to your intention. Okay? Yeah? They talk about this in Abhidharma. There's another thing called a non-vow, which is when people make very strong intentions, even though they haven't taken precepts. So, for example, a butcher, yeah, has a very strong intention to kill animals. So they accumulate a lot of negative karma from this. They call it a non-vow, but it doesn't, there's probably a better translation. But it's because they're living according with that intention that they've taken. So each time they kill, it becomes something very heavy. So that's why it's really important to check the groups we hang out with, because also in terms of collective karma, we create collective karma if we're participating in a group that has a non-virtuous function. And furthermore, we get more conditioning for our own non-virtuous actions when we do that. Yeah. And much more chance of rejoicing in others' non-virtue. Yeah?
I have a question about the showing respect and paying homage versus the idol worship.
Okay, that's a good question. The difference between showing respect and paying homage and idol worship. Okay, idol worship, you're worshiping the material. Okay, so it might be, the Buddha statue is made of bronze. Okay, you're worshiping that lump of bronze. You think that lump of bronze is going to give you some kind of blessing or whatever. Okay, so that's more the form of idol worship. Yeah. What we're doing actually when we see a Buddha statue is we are thinking of the Buddha's qualities and that statue as a representative of those qualities. Okay, and so we show respect to the statue as because it evokes in us the memory of the Buddha's qualities. Now they also say that when you get to, what is it, one of the, I forget which level on the path of accumulation, then you can see statues as the actual Nirmanakaya Buddha. Okay? So, in one sense, when you think of a Buddha, I mean, I'm just going to talk some of my ideas here, okay? Mm-hmm. But, when you think about a statue being consecrated, you're invoking all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to abide in that statue. So in one way, you could think, oh, there's an actual Buddha there that I'm showing respect to. But then the question comes, if the Buddha's mind pervades everything and the Buddha's body pervades everything, then you don't even need to consecrate a statue, or you don't need, the wall could have the Buddha's mind and Buddha's body pervading it. So, do you show respect to the wall? I think it probably depends upon one's level of practice, how you think. I would think it very much depends on your level of practice. And I think consecration is done because it's a way for us ordinary people to really start to think, oh, now the Buddha's abiding here. Before the Buddha wasn't, and now the Buddha's abiding here. When actually, it makes no difference at all, but it helps our conventional, ordinary, childish mind. Yeah. But in terms of with the Sangha, it's not idol worship. The Sangha isn't an idol at all, kind of just human beings there. But you're respecting the precepts that are in their mental continuum, and you're respecting whatever level of practice they've done. You're not respecting their bad qualities. You're not respecting their negative karma if they happen to be ordinary people. Okay? So it's not any kind of idol worship like that. Don't say that word. Okay. So the whole thing, why, you know, the term guru devotion is forbidden here. Okay?
Can we use it to refer to that wrong way?
Yeah, you can call it at the wrong translation. You can, when you're talking about the wrong translation, you can say the term. Because that way of thinking, just alone that way of thinking screws us up. Because we think of guru as like, and then devotion, it's like, you know, oh, I'm so devoted to my guru, the Buddha. You know, and you become like a teenage groupie with, you know, no wisdom at all. Okay? So the thing is, and why I think it's important that we start out, and as Holiness talks about this a lot, that there's different levels of spiritual mentors. There's the spiritual mentor who's at the Vinaya level, the one that you take refuge and you lay precepts from. Then there's this, and your monastic vows from. That's your Vinaya spiritual mentor. Then there's the Mahayana spiritual mentor, the one you take your Bodhisattva vows from, who teaches you, you know, your Bodhisattva way of practice. Then there's the Tantric Lama, the Tantric spiritual mentor, who gives you initiation and gives you the Tantric vows. So there's the three different levels of practice. The requirements to be a spiritual mentor at these three levels are different, okay, because they're different levels of practice. And so how you see these three levels of spiritual mentors is different, okay. It's only at the level of, you know, highest, well, and actually in all the Tantra practice, where you see the teacher as the Buddha. But actually, as His Holiness says, in all of Tantric practice, you're trying to see all the living beings around you as Buddhas and the environment as the Pure Land. So what are you going to do? Leave your teacher out? I think your teacher's an ordinary being, but everybody else is a deity, you know? That's ridiculous. So of course, you know, and when you take an initiation, if you think that you're taking it from the actual deity, then, you know, you pay better attention and it leaves a stronger imprint in your mind and you take the practice more seriously. So, of course, in Tantra, you see the teacher as the Buddha. In Mahayana practice, you see your spiritual mentor as an emanation of the Buddha. Okay? Your Vinaya teacher, you see as a representative of the Buddha. In other words, you know, the Buddha's not here. Shakyamuni Buddha passed away all those centuries ago. And your teacher is the representative of the Buddha because they're the ones who are giving you the, you know, your lay vows or your monastic ordination. Okay? So there's different levels of requirement also for being one of these spiritual teachers. Okay? And I think one of the things, okay, here's part of, you know, my own personal view. What I think has happened a lot, and I gained this view through hanging out with my friends who belong to different Buddhist traditions and see how much in the Theravada tradition and in the Chinese tradition the Sangha is respected, and respected not only by the lay people but also by the Sangha itself, you know, the Sangha treats each other very well. And why in the Tibetan tradition we call each other by our first names, we don't use a title, and so on. And one of the reasons I think is because, you know, the Tibetan tradition emphasizes Tantra so much that people from the get-go only pay attention to their teacher. And they put so much emphasis on my teacher is the Buddha and my teacher is a holy being that anybody else who's sitting in class with you, whether they're ordained or not, is just Joe Schmo. And they even forget the tantric root vow about talking about the faults of your Vajra brothers and sisters. You know, that one is out the window, because they're just so busy showing devotion to their teacher. Okay? But, and I think that's one reason why the Westerners who have ordained in the Tibetan tradition, why we have so few communities, and why it's difficult for us to form communities, is because the tradition as a whole, everything is so vertical, and it only goes to the guru. And so it's not, in a Sangha community, things are horizontal. You know, I mean, of course, there's a hierarchy between juniors and seniors and lay and Sangha. But there's a lot of horizontal things going on in the Sangha either, because, you know, you're all equals in one respect when you're fully ordained. Okay? But the Tibetan tradition doesn't, you know, it ignores those things and just goes straight to the Tantric Lama. And so I think that that's part of the reason, you know, why it's been difficult in our tradition, and why when you go with the people in the other Buddhist traditions, that the Western Sangha in the Theravada tradition, they give monastic ordination. Okay, they're giving the ordination. The Chinese Sangha, you know, as a whole, they give ordination. They do all sorts of things, you know. The Western Sangha in the Tibetan tradition, if you dare give ordination, everybody's going to think you're very arrogant. Isn't it? You know? And yet, even if you have the requirements according to Vinaya, because everybody just thinks Tantric Lama. Yeah? So nobody learns how to respect the Sangha as a whole. And I think I would like to see this brought back, you know, this become a more substantial part of our tradition, because I think it creates harmony in the Buddhist community, you know, when we learn to respect each other. I think the Western Sangha has a better chance of coming together as a group when we're based on mutual respect. I think Sangha keeps their vows better when they're respected. Okay? Because I know, like, when I went to Singapore and all these sudden these people are showing me such respect, I felt, whoa, you know, I better be worthy of this. Whereas if you're living in a Dharma center and people just treat you like, you know, it's your turn to do dishes and, you know, here do this, here do that, then sometimes it's very easy for people to think, you know, well, there's nothing special about being ordained, or people treat me like Joe Blow anyway. I don't have to be careful of how I keep my precepts. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas when lay people or other Sangha show you respect, at least for me, it's like, whoa, you know. And so that's the whole thing, too. Here, I mean, we're eating the food that has been offered by people to respect. The food's getting offered to the Sangha. There's two Sangha members here. You know, you're eating from that. But it's still this thing of like people are supporting the Abbey because of the values and the ethical discipline and the practice we do here. So that means we have some obligation to try and practice well and keep our precepts well and not just expect food to show up and on the table, you know, because it's being donated to us, you know, with faith. Okay? And that's why after lunch, you know, the prostration to the one Buddha and then the mantra we say in Sanskrit, that's done in order to purify any negativity we may have accumulated through having not kept our precepts or not practiced well and yet consume the offerings of those who have given offerings in faith. Okay? And they say that if you don't keep your precepts well and you consume offerings given in faith, you might as well be drinking red hot molten iron, because it's a direct ticket to the hell realm. Because you're abusing people's faith. Yeah? So that's why we say the mantras after that. That's why we dedicate for them after, you know, we eat the meal, even chanting, you know, the text that we do. It's a way of, you know, putting our mind back into virtue after the meal, recognizing that we're alive because of the kindness of other people who have offered the food. So it becomes a big wake-up call to you in your practice, doesn't it, when other people show respect and make offerings to you? Okay? So I think it really enhances the practice, and that's another reason why I would like to see, you know, the Tibetan Sangha, you know, the Western Sangha respected more. Usually the Tibetans, you know, among Tibetan society, people respect the lamas much more than the Sangha in general. But in the West, if you're Tibetan Sangha, it doesn't matter, you've been ordained 5 minutes, people are ready to throw everything at your feet. And, you know, it's a reverse form of racism. Mm-hmm. But it's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But, you know, anybody in vows, you know, no matter who they are, you know, is worthy of respect because of their vows. But then also we, you know, when you're living here, have to be aware, you know, you have lay vows and to keep them well and so on. Okay? And that's why I hope you're still doing the practice, you know, bowing to each other in the morning and bowing to each other in the evening. You know, when I come in the kitchen in the morning, we bow to each other. I mean, I think this whole thing of bowing to each other and showing respect is, it's a very wonderful mental training for us. Yeah, because even, you know, somebody said something you didn't like and, you know, you're offended and your feelings are hurt. You know, you can still go, you can still bow to somebody, you know, because you see they have some good qualities. Yeah.
So, I'm curious then about, in our efforts as a community here, as far as like going to the airport with kashas and waiting for you and getting first in the food line, sometimes I'm a little confused on what I, where the informality ends of just being, living together 24 hours
mm-hmm.
a day and where my etiquette and respect and what my teacher, I get a little, those places sometimes get a little blurry. And I'm
yeah.
not sure when I'm being really silly or really being mindless or whether the formalities can be eased somewhat because of the living environment that we're here.
Yeah. I mean, some of that has to do with your mind, yeah. I think at the airport, I think there's something very nice about that, you know. Like when you're first seeing your teacher the first time. I mean, I know when I go to Deer Park and I'm, you know, seeing Geshe Lal going off for kata, you know, before class, or, you know, when my teachers are coming here going to the airport offering kata. I think whenever there's a thing of food being offered, of food being served, okay, when there's a thing of cleaning up and stuff like that, you know, if, and then also if there's a thing that somebody's going to have to break a precept, then, you know, then you don't make them break a precept. I mean, that's why Joan came to dig the thistles out today, because I don't dig in the ground. So things like that, where, you know, you would do that, or working in the garden and stuff like that. Definitely in the meditation hall, you use etiquette. I mean, in other things, when we're just having a community meeting and talking about, you know, yeah, framing the window or whatever, then, you know, kind of everybody's all the, you know, relatively the same, and we should treat each other all with respect. Yeah. When it comes to setting the vision for the Abbey, then clearly the monastics have to take the lead in that. Okay, that makes some kind of sense?
I mean, for sure, it sometimes needs to... paying attention,
mm-hmm.
and also how my relationship to monastics, I mean, it's a fairly, you really are the only monastic I've had any in-depth relationship to,
mm-hmm.
and at times, sometimes, there's a, kind of like just a more relaxed and formal sort of environment
right.
here. That's where I think I get a little
yeah.
lax, and then still don't see the differentiation when I need to sort of pump it up a little bit because
yeah.
you're doing a ritual or we're doing
mm-hmm.
a teaching. I forget to
yeah.
prostrate after you've given a teaching because I just haven't done it for a few weeks because it's the first teaching in a few weeks and I
yeah.
forget.
Yeah.
I'm not vigilant enough about when I can just turn myself
yeah.
on.
And there are times when you're more formal and times when you're more informal. Because I know with my teachers as well, there's times in a teaching situation you're very formal, you know. But it's a different kind of relationship because, I mean, like with a professor, you don't live with your professor usually. And, you know, and already there's enough formality there. Hopefully you don't live with your professor. you know, in a monastic context, you do everything together. And so you see everybody in all sorts of aspects of the day. And, you know, they're walking around in their underskirt and their T-shirt. You know, they're not wearing their gold robe because it's a special occasion. You know, they're, you know, wearing their underskirt or they're, you know, or they're just sitting on the sofa reading in a relaxed position, hopefully not splayed out. But, you know, so there are situations, you know, I mean, you have to have a certain feeling of relaxation. Otherwise, everything just gets so uptight and erotic.
For me, I just don't want it to be so, like, relaxed that I forget the other part. You know, a little bit more formal and there's an etiquette. I haven't quite figured out, mostly by watching.
And you do it by watching and... And, you know, I don't think that there's not an inherently existent kind of line there. So it's, you know, I mean, I think everybody just needs to be kind of a little bit at ease. I mean, I know as I travel in America, I have to be totally open. Because when I land, and it's very interesting going on a teaching tour, going from place to place, because you get treated in, you know, you have no idea how they're going to treat you when you get off the airplane in some of these places. You know, some people are there with flowers and katas, and they take your luggage, and they call you venerable. And some people are there, and you're sitting there pulling your own luggage, and they don't, you know. And you lift it into the car, and, yeah, so you have to have some degree of flexibility, especially here in the West. And then also, you know, as you get to know somebody, too, things become more informal. Yeah, I mean, when I stay in Sherpa Rinpoche's house, I'm very informal with him. But then when other guests come, then I become more formal because it's more appropriate, you know, when there's other people there who are guests, that I'm more formal with him. But when those people aren't there, he doesn't like me to be formal. Just cut it out.
See, there's a time difference because when we have our neighbors who aren't
here
to come to the open house and stuff, we don't
use the certain terms. Right. Yeah, so when we're with the neighbors, don't call me venerable because they might think it's a little bit weird. Yeah. And if you do, you don't have to gasp and go, oh, I mean children. You know? I mean,
well,
people.
Sorry to call you venerable.
Really?
She started to interchange them.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. It's quietly.